Let's just start with how you see the importance of the spoken word.
Okay, the importance of the spoken word is because our people never had the luxury of writing down and recording very important events and the geography and the importance of the geography and all of the other things that are included in preparing one generation to the next generation. So all of these things weren't written anywhere. What happened was is that there were people like everything in society, there are some people in certain families who take an interest in listening very, very intensely to the stories and to the information that is being provided from the elders through the storytelling process. And what happens is that those people in turn continue to pass these stories onward. And not everybody, you know, if there's a room full of young adults, we'd say, teenagers that come to a person's house, which was the way of our people, because there wasn't any other means of communication. We didn't have televisions and recorders and cameras and all this type of stuff. So people congregated to people to the elders' homes, and then the elders would tell stories, and some of those stories would be just humorous stories, and because humor was a big part of our culture and part of our medicine. And then there were stories that were much more serious, and these stories would include the geography, all by identified by various different place names, and these place names would be given sometimes in honor to the person who spent the most time in that particular area. Just as an example, we still talk about Paulet's wigwam. Now, Paulet was an old gentleman by the name of Paul Benoit, who was like four or five generations of trapping on the Fishel's River, and there was a wigwam built in that one particular location. And when you're a boy or a girl, it doesn't matter, but when you're 7 or 8, 9 year old and you're listening to stories and they're talking about Paulet's wigwam, there's a certain excitement that is building into you, and you can't wait for the day to come when you're going to be able to visit that location. Because it's, because that's what we did. That was our entertainment. That was our way of life. So you're all excited about going there. And when you go there for the first time, I mean, that excitement is celebrated to be in that particular location. So these kind of stories are the stories that were being told in the homes, and by the elders. And then out of the half a dozen or so young people that would be gathered in that house for that particular story, there might be only one or two who will carry on that tradition. Other people may go their separate ways and do whatever they need to do to survive in society, but there'll always be somebody, if not in that one particular group, over a period of time in some other group that will be congregated. There's always opportunity for the people who want to become and who take on that responsibility of becoming the knowledge keepers, we'll call them, to be able to relate those stories to their children, their grandchildren, and other children in the community as they get older, as they continue their lifestyle. So that was the importance of the spoken word. If we took it a little further, to my time and my involvement in the Aboriginal movement, I have no evidence to substantiate that, but I believe that the conversations that we were able to have when we made that connection with the university, and we had people like Adrian Tanner and Dennis Bartel, and there's a whole range of different people who were in the university that we spoke to. They didn't doubt or shun us. What happened was is that they seeked confirmation on our presence and on our existence here in the province. So the research work that they, from an academic perspective, only confirmed the things that we had kept alive, through oral traditions in our communities. And the stories, like, for instance, you know, the research on Cormac and all of the other people who had late comers to the island of Newfoundland, we knew all of those things, but we knew them as stories in a different term. If we talked about the Cormac journey, we never talked specifically about Cormac. We talked about Sylvester Joe, his guide, and how he had met up with the Gabriels at Gabriel's Pond. And so the stories was the stories about our people, not about the Europeans that were coming here. But in a lot of our stories, and with the Con River one is another example about the Con River people being aware of having a reserve in their community. And then later on, historians being able to find the evidence with regard to that land that had been set aside for the Aboriginal people. So the stories are very legitimate stories and are very important stories, and they can be, and many of them have been, collaborated by today's academics, which shows the value of those stories, because had those stories not been kept alive, had they not been surfaced, there would have been nothing to trigger the interests of the people I just before mentioned to be able to dig deep in research with regard to Mi'kmaq people on the island of Newfoundland. So I believe, and maybe I'm biased because of my involvement, but I believe that our historical way of bringing forward our history through speech, through stories, I believe that was part of the trigger to inspire the academics to be able to dig deeper and confirm the things that we have been talking about.
Yeah, like you just raised a whole bunch of questions in my mind, right? But one thing I'd like to jump back to is how do you think that, what did you call them, the knowledge keepers?
Like yes.
The communicators, storytellers,
yes.
Maybe?
Knowledge keepers, yes.
How would they be identified? Would they identify themselves? Would that be like some kind of innate thing? Would it run in certain families?
Not really. It would run in certain families, but what would happen is that the elders themselves were very keen and they were the people who identified the knowledge keepers. Like they could tell by the interest that was shown when those stories were being told, and by the returning to the same houses and returning to that person with questions, that's what triggered their understanding or their knowledge of spending as much time as possible with that person, because that person was identified as a potential of being a knowledge carrier.
Interesting. Well, let's jump right into Mun then. So Mun has, and I would say with big input from Kellyanne, Mun has adopted what they call almost unique in Canada, like a Indigenous policies for research. They talk about indigenization of the university now. How do you think that by developing Indigenous pedagogies which would respect the primacy of the spoken word, how do you think that that would benefit the university, or even more, how would that work?
Well, I can see it as having benefit for the university, but I can see it as having more benefit for the Aboriginal community, far more benefit, because what happens is that there's and rightfully so, there's a very, very high degree of respect for the universities, a very, very high degree of respect for the universities, because they very little, very seldom show bias, and they very seldom show politics, and, you know, it's there, it's everywhere, but I mean, that's not the main thrust of it. So what would happen is that, for instance, and I'll use probably one of the most recognized topics across this country. If we're looking at talking about, and we are talking about land claims, and the time will come, if not in my generation, if not in my day, but down the road sometime, because land claims is a long undertaking, and should that come to a level whereby it will be either negotiated or discussed in the courts, more than likely in the courts, I could see the university, people in the university who have been engaged and who continue to be engaged with Aboriginal people, becoming very important witnesses, for the simple reason that they have the ability to be able to do confirmation of the evidence that we would be putting forward, and that's happening now it's been happening since the early 70s, what I talked about earlier, people being able to confirm the stories. So they would, I would look at them being the university, I would look at the university as being the expert witness that would be required with regard to the arguments that we would be putting forward with regard to land use and occupancy. And that evidence is certainly there, and it's continuing to build every time there's an undertaking between an Aboriginal community and the university. The university is getting a first-hand experience on the way of life of people, the philosophy of those people, and of course the continued history of those people. And just to sum that up, if I could, Fred, is that the argument that will be probably be put forward by the Mi'kmaq people of Newfoundland will be an argument for land claims based on land use and occupancy. And the policy of the federal government, unless it just recently changed, is that you have to show that you were living here pre-Confederation, that you were not pre-Confederation, but pre-European sovereignty, and that you continue to practice that way of life, and that we are practicing that way of life up to the present day. Now, of course, there's room for argument, and we don't deny that. But that becomes part of the legitimate argument, is that as everything evolves, as everything changes, of course, that way of life is going to change too. And if, for instance, that some of the policies, and there's not, for instance, it's factual, that some of the policies that were enacted by the government forced our people to change a way of life, that's not a surrender of your way of life. That's something you had no other choice to do. So that becomes part of our argument. Some of the things that we're involved in today, like for instance, maybe the commercial fishing, is that people were forced to go into commercial fishing because they were no longer allowed to be able to do it under government policies and laws and regulations, the traditional way that we did it. So it doesn't mean that we discontinued a way of life. It means that we were pushed out of a way of life and had to adapt something else to replace that. The involvement on a continuous basis with the university gives us an opportunity to be able to have the university as a witness, that's what I said earlier, to the changes that are imposed upon us, not changes that we ourselves promote.
One of the, I've got a big stack of books that for some reason I've been buying. Like I go to Millbrook because Millbrook's not that far away, and they have this huge bookstore. So one of the books that I bought last fall, I believe, was a book by edited by Marie Baptiste from Cape Breton. Right. And anyway, the book is a collection of writings, but it's called The Living Treaties. And in it, she starts talking about the oral traditions and the oral history with the wampum belts of treaties with, the colonizers for hundreds of years. So she's right. Talking about I would call it collective memory. I think that's the collective right. memory of the Mi'kmaq is oral, whereas a lot of these treaties that were made have just totally been lost or deliberately lost or, hidden away.
Right. Right. Yeah. So very little has been written about the treaties. And of course, what have been written it's European document. I mean, because our people didn't write. So it's obvious that you'll have two versions of the treaties. You know, that's a given. However, the continued practice of the Mi'kmaq people throughout the Atlantic region are in line with their interpretation and what they believe to be the substance of the treaties. So and I mean that has been proven. The Donald Marshall case is a prime example. The Donald Marshall case was won because of the treaty argument. So so it's very important to continue those teachings and align them with the activities of the people today.
Like for me, there are a number of different threads in this. Like one is like what I'm learning from you and Kellyanne and others about the Mi'kmaq history. Then there's my own actual personal of going from being a, you know, like a newspaper editor, like totally into print, and then moving out into community radio and community media with Extension. But there's another one that came from because I was working with this kind of open systems thinking as opposed to closed systems thinking with the Australians. And the Australians, these people claim to be totally influenced by 40,000 years of Aboriginal history. So the writing, which almost got me into this, which is not really about, but it is in a way, I'm going to say it's not about Aboriginal history, but it is in a way, is an actual essay written by this man who is one of the founders. Anyway, he talks about, that's where I got the word about restoring the primacy of the spoken word. And what he suggests is that the spoken word is and always has been the language of the people, where the communication of the people, whereas the written word is the communication of the conquerors, of the oppressors, right?
Yes, and yes, it's true. The spoken word, I won't call it a criteria, but one of the importance that that people are taught when they're going to rely on, when they're going to use this spoken word, is that, I remember this as a boy coming from my grandfather, because my grandfather was a storyteller, and we were always told in groups or individual, didn't really matter, but we were always told that your story has to be based of course on the facts that are presented to you, but the important part of your story is the logic, because our people very much value and depend on logic. If you know what I'm saying, you know where I'm coming from. Yes. Like logic is most important. And like even a hunter or a trapper, what you do is you design your traps, you design the place you're going to set your traps, you do all of those things based on logic. Because logic is the premises for success. That you know, without any logic, you don't have any, and this is why in the other part of our education system, the practical comes before the theory. If you know the practical, you can go out and you can work, and then you can learn the theory from experimenting, from doing different things. You know if you've done it wrong, you know if you've done it right. Where in the academic system that's been introduced to us from colonialism, it's you go and you do the theory, and then you're given a diploma and then you're sent to work, but you really don't know anything. You know everything on paper, but you don't know how to do anything. And that was the opposite to the way that I was taught as a boy growing up, is that you go and you learn how to do things, but then you learn why are you doing it that way, and why do it have to be done that way? So I don't know if this addresses your question, but it just come to my mind as I was talking about that.
Yeah, and it's good. No, this is very interesting because I've been a teacher a lot for many years, right? And I totally agree. From my practice of teaching, that's exactly it. Well, it's like your brother. Your brother came into the journalism program, and he was like doing. They were doing. They were doing. They were doing. It was like, and then the theory comes afterwards. And I have to tell you, my very first presentation in this PhD program, I asked the question. I said, is there room in this program for a practitioner? Because that's what I consider myself, right? And I asked, is it possible for, instead of people just learning theory, is it possible for a practitioner to come in to learn theory? So for me, like bang on, right? One of the things that I come across in this kind of like overall discussion of the spoken word, I went to visit a friend of mine. I was asking him some questions about, he's a management consultant, like with universities, a Belgian guy, bilingual guy. Anyway, he was asking me what I was doing. I stayed there for supper, him and his wife and his brother-in-law. And so he asked me what I was doing. And I mentioned this about the spoken word. Well, he got really excited about it, right? And I said I was going to call it the legitimization of the spoken word. And he said, no, no, no. Called the re-legitimization of the spoken word. And he started yanking books off his shelves and stuff like that. Because, I mean, the point is that in the whole history of human beings being on Earth, the written word hasn't been around that long, you
That's
know?
right. Exactly.
And if you talk about it in terms of what, because of where I am, like on the water, underneath Blomidon and all that kind of stuff, I'm very conscious of the 11,000 years of Mi'kmaq history in Atlantic Canada. And so if you, what I'm thinking, like you have, I mean, how long have the European invaders been here? Like what, 400 or 500 years? But you have all the rest of those thousands and thousands of years of oral history and oral traditions.
But even looking at it from that, yes, looking at that argument and applying my teaching of logic, even the written word has come from the spoken word. Because how else would it happen? I mean, and what people, if people lock themselves in a room and they write something, where did they get the information or what inspired them to write that if it wasn't from the spoken word? If it's not from the spoken word, then what it is, it must be far from factual, because then it becomes fiction. We can dream all kinds of things, we can say all kinds of things, and we can write them all down, and then in 100 years they'll become the written texts. But where did we get them from? Where what inspired us to do that? Was it fiction or was it spoken word? It's
Yeah.
kind of like the chicken and egg, what comes first, chicken or the egg? And in all of the writings, it's again applying logic. They're only inspired by the spoken word.
Yeah, one of the things that this Australian guy talks about, and actually he in World War, his wife, Marilyn Emery, who I communicate with, she was actually raised among Aboriginal people. She's like of a European background, but and so she played with Aboriginal children and she spoke the language, right, of the dialect or whatever. And anyway, she was interviewed by this guy who I call a Mohawk scholar, like and he wrote a lot about that, like the connections between the Mohawk oral tradition and what. Anyway, he had her, she said that she's still, and she's like 80 plus years old now. She still sometimes dreams in the Aboriginal language, right? And she wakes up knowing that she's been dreaming in the Aboriginal language. Yeah, my brother's here, and his friend's doing a wash, and I've got the whole backseat of my car filled with the wash to do too, because I don't have enough water in my well to do washes where I am. So one of the things, back to the train of thought. So Fred Emery wrote this, what I've been referring to, and it's kind of interesting. He was Marilyn's husband, And it's kind of interesting because, and he's an inventor of this whole kind of system of open system of thinking. But the more I learn about like Mi'kmaq oral tradition and sort of non-hierarchical gatherings of people, the more I realized that if, and that's what Philip, the Mohawk scholar, talks about, is the whole thing about open systems thinking is indigenous thinking. Because it's not closed, it's open. It's open to discovering and open to change, and it's flexible and stuff. Anyway, one of the things that Fred Emery was very, though he's now recognized as Australia's greatest social scientist, and he's dead. During World War II, he had to he was under threat of arrest because he talked too openly, right? And he had to actually spent World War II living among Aboriginal people. Because they protected him from the government, right? But anyway, what he one of the things he says in this article is in support of the spoken word, he says that human beings are hardwired to talk. We start communicating by speech the moment we're born, right? And but the work that goes in to teaching people how to write and communicate in writing is it goes on for 12 years or 20 years to try and teach people, like in this PhD program, they're still trying to teach people how to write. So it's not really natural way of communication.
That's right.
So do you think it's going to be a hard push to get the university to accept what Fred Emery called the primacy of the spoken word?
More than likely it will be, because the university is has such a broad responsibility. It's not like if they were dealing with one nation or one group of people. And of course, they whatever they're going to do, they have to phase into it slowly, because they need the rest of society to be able to understand and accept. So I wouldn't suspect or expect the university to make a drastic change, immediately. It's not like flicking a switch. It's and there will be pushback. There will be people within that system, within that institute, who will be contradictory to that. They won't want those kind of things. But what will be important is that the groups, in our particular case, since we're talking about us, what is going to be very important is that the people who align themselves and associate themselves with the university, and I'm one of those people, of course, but we all need to make sure that we need to make sure that we that what we ask the university to do at this point in time can be this what's the word I'm looking for? It can be recognized as being factual. It can be facts checked is the word I'm looking for. It can be facts checked. So because there's still a lot of stuff out there that a lot of things that we talk about, a lot of things that we know, there's still evidence out there that need to be researched and uncovered. And that's what the university has been really good at. That's what they've been able to do over the last 50 years that we've been involved with them, since 1970. A number of various different people in the university has taken it on to themselves, as different projects, whatnot, to be able to find historical references and documents, as sometimes as small as they may be. But what they do is they collaborate our stories and our history as given from our perspective. So what we need to do is we need to continue that journey for a while yet, because if not, I'm afraid of failure, because it's not like we can go into the university and gather all of the professors in one room and the faculty staff and convince them that this is what we need to do from here forward. So it's going to be a trial and error, and at least I believe it'll be a trial and error, and it'll be a process whereby the university will be able to determine. There'll be people in the university who will determine who they should be talking to and who they should be working with. And then from our perspective, there'll be the same thing will be happening we will identify people in the university that we feel comfortable with, that we will want to continue to work with. We'll find other people that we realize that we don't have anything in common to be able to make a connection to start to continue this dialogue. So it's I see it as being a work in progress.
Yeah, it's interesting. Like I told you, I was reading Marie Batiste on the Living Treaties, and I mean, she's quite amazing, right? And a very strong, like I would say, activist in changing. And she's very critical, even though she's part of the university and stuff. She's very critical. But what she talks about is she talks about the work of the activists and the allies. And I found it kind of interesting because I try to think of, like, my younger daughter is my biggest critic. And one of the things she criticizes me about is, say, for example, when I start talking about Aboriginal culture, you know, as Philip says, it was one of the gentlest cultures on earth. And they were just so dismayed in meeting these violent European invaders, right? It said they died of despair, right? Anyway, my daughter criticizes me and says, I have no right to be doing what I'm doing now, like talking to you about this. She says that that this is the Mi'kmaq's property and that kind of stuff. But one of the words that Marie Batiste uses is allies.
Yes.
She talks about the activists and the allies.
Exactly. And the thing about it is that, you know, and I've had this conversation with a number of different leaders over the years that when traveling around that, is that Anything that Aboriginal people are not comfortable with, they won't engage into it. So the fact that I'm sitting down here engaging this conversation with you is a testimony to my sincerity and my belief that this is a process that can work. If I had doubt that this was a wasted effort, I wouldn't even engage, because that's the way of our people. Our people are they either engage or they walk away from it. Okay? There's no in between. That's how we look at it. And the engagement is, with regard to activists and allies, there's testimony to that too, because you take myself and Marilyn John and Jerry Wetzel and Tony John and all the rest of us that started this organization back in the early 70s. You know, if not for a number of professors around the university, we wouldn't have gained the momentum that we gained and move at the speed that we move. It was through the collaboration of the Aboriginal community and the people who saw us as being sincere and believed us that we were able to move forward. Because, like, you know, who in their, you know, there's no way in the world that I could ever imagine sitting down with a politician and continuing and convincing him that there were Aboriginal people in Flat Bay. You know, it took a document from, you know, historical document uncovered by a professor from the university to be able to place that evidence in my hand that I could sit down and pass the evidence in written form across the table. Because spoken history was not accepted, maybe a little bit more listened to now, but it wasn't accepted back 50 years ago and for the longest time, and in a lot of circles still not accepted yet. So what I needed was, I needed a document that I had no idea that it existed or no knowledge of how to be able to uncover that, because I didn't have any academic training. But when somebody found, or somebody just happened to look at the 1945 census and said the people of Flat Bay identified themselves as French-speaking Indians in the 1945 census, there was the document, there was the evidence that I had that I could lay in front of a bureaucrat and say, well, look, you people had to know we were here when we joined Confederation because our people identified themselves in 1945. So the collaboration was from the 70s up to this day, very, very important, and will continue to be important, and that's a good way to identify, you know, the activists and the allies.
One thing, I know you've got other stuff to do and all that kind of stuff, but one of, like, And I'm totally learning in all this, if you know what I mean. It's kind of like I'm just kind of feeling my way to learning. But, you know, Bev Kirby always talked about the importance of lifelong learning, right? And,
Yes.
but I, and one of the things I've learned about, like from Kellyanne and her course, was the Marshall concept, I guess, of two-eyed seeing. Is that what it's called?
Yes, Albert
And
Marshall, yeah.
what I'm wondering is, in a way, is that a way of introducing into the university? In other words, for now, we'll leave them with their written documents and their readings and their citations, but we will introduce the concept of, instead of trying to take over what they're doing and replace it, what we would do is just continuously build up the spoken word. Am I making any
Yes,
sense?
yeah. Yeah. And doing, and I'm sure I'm repeating myself now, but you know, when we talk about information that should be out there, when we say, you know, that people visit our coast and people had trade, you know, with Aboriginal people and all these signs there. So there has to be notes, there has to be things out there. And when we talk about certain things, if we can find the teachings that we know that could not have been ignored, even if it's only just one-liners in some of those notes that were kept by the visiting, either, you know, whoever was visiting our shores at the particular time, if we can find little drips and drabs of these stories, and then if we can ask the university to either confirm or deny these actions, that's where we're putting credibility to the spoken word. Credibility will surface to the spoken word because they will be eager because they've shown that in the past. The university have shown eagerness. They were very eager and very willing to be able to go and look for information, look for documentation. You know, just as one example, there is two references about a tract of land being allocated to the Mi'kmaq in Bay St. George. Nobody has been successful up to this point in time in being able to track down that particular document, if it exists, with regard to where and who was involved in the transaction of that bit of land. But if we could encourage some focus on that particular one item, because the common knowledge is here. We always knew about it, like was passed on, but we don't know how much or where. We just know that land was set aside in Bay St. George for Aboriginal people, and there are two references to that. So by engaging the university with those references, somebody may take on that responsibility of digging deeper because they have, you know, they have a wide net of acquaintances and be able to probably find that one missing document that is out there. But equally important is that while looking for that missing document, there may be other things that has been overlooked or not found that may be small but very important. Did that make any sense?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I was thinking, you know, like I was thinking like back to I was thinking about Neil Tilley actually, and when like back in the early days, well, it was actually the end of Extension, right? But Neil was a good friend of mine. He was very active, and he worked with so many different groups across the province, including the Native Friendship Center. And so when I was at MUN in St. John's, through his guidance or, you know, pushing or whatever, I became very actively involved with the Native Friendship Center. We did things like we did a film series about showing only Indigenous films, and I did workshops in, you know, communication, journalism. But one thing they asked me to do, I was on a trip up to Labrador on something else, and they asked me when I was in Maine to go around and make a what I would have to describe as a changes of attitude video. And it was based on in something like one of the grade eight textbooks, there was a portrayal of Maine that showed igloos and all this kind of stuff. And of course, I mean, Maine jumps all the time, but at that time, you know, they had the radio station, they had a big school, they had like a big store with all. So anyway, I went around the whole community and I just made a changes of attitude video. So that and it was like the spoken word. It was like that to change what was in the textbook. And then more recently, we've talked about this before. I was at a friend's place in Norris Point, like a good friend of mine, but he's grew up in St. John's and all that kind of stuff. And he started saying something, and I've heard it from other friends who are like educators, right? And it's about the whole thing of the Mi'kmaq being brought to Newfoundland to kill the Beothuk, right? And I knew nothing about it. I mean, this is years ago, right? And I jumped him. I said, "This is absolutely ridiculous. This is obviously some kind of English propaganda, right? I mean, there's absolutely no truth, and I'm totally shocked you would even say anything like that, right?" But then you explained it to me. Do you want to like explain that story more? Like, what's the history of that story? Because that's a change. People are still talking about that today. I don't know if it's still in the textbooks, but it's insane, right? People are being educated I don't know. I would call it cultural genocide, right?
Because there's a number of scholars that have looked and written on that, and there is no evidence whatsoever. There is absolutely no evidence whatsoever to be able to substantiate that myth that Mi'kmaq were brought here to kill the Beothuk. There is none. There is no evidence. And what it was simply that the Europeans who were slaughtering Beothuk, they needed to blame somebody else, and that's what happened, as far as we're concerned. Like, you know, because like I said, there is no evidence.
I think
There
one
wasn't
time you
there wasn't
actually gave me
one
the
there
name of the
wasn't one
man, didn't you? The man who came in,
who who came in what who came into
I think he was
I just
actually part of the U.S. militia that was tied in with the English. But anyway, he invented the story way back in the maybe I read that somewhere.
I think yeah I think it was Peyton. Peyton. I think it was Peyton was the name. I'm not sure now, but I think it might have been Peyton.
And you know, like I again, like I'm totally unknowledgeable about this. Like this is not my field, but I work a lot around the province, and I work on Fogo Island, and there are actually stories of the Europeans killing the Beothuk there. You
Oh,
know, because the
definitely.
Beothuk wouldn't have guns or anything like that, and the Europeans were actually hunting them down on Fogo Island to get rid of them, right? Anyway, that's a bad note to end on. But
No, but it is a myth that and was a created story. And then again, like, you know, the how would you feel if you're a young student, 10 or 11 year old, and you're sitting in a classroom and you're doing a history lesson, and in the history they're talking about your people being brought here to kill another nation, to kill another people. You know, there's trauma, there's guilt, there's denial, there's all of those things that would come over you because of that. I mean, nobody, especially at a very early age, when you can't defend yourself, even if it was true, it's still the wrong thing to be teaching in a school text. It may be conversation. It may be good conversation for university students, but it's not a good conversation I think it was in grade 4 or grade 5 history book. I'm not sure now, but I think that's how early it was. But it's not a good conversation for that age, especially if you're living in a Mi'kmaq community and going to a European school.
Yeah, Well, like in my own personal history, on my mother's side of the family, it goes back to like Scottish gypsies or Roma, and actually just a couple generations, right? And the way that that group of people has been persecuted through history and continues to be persecuted, I think it's, and they're travelers, right? They do settle, but they're nomadic people. And I've always thought, and actually I used it in a conversation, and I think it almost applies today to outports. And anyway, it's the, when you get like these established, centralized colonial governments, one of the things they hate the most are free people. They, you know, and I think it almost applies to St. John's attitude towards outports. Outport people tend to be free people, I think.
Well, what happens is I tied with that question for the longest time because I've heard so much on the resettlement program, and I've heard so many different people on the radio shows, and even some of the moderators of the radio shows talking about the cost of small communities, outport communities, and the cost of keeping those communities and all that. And as I listen to that, I spend a lot of time thinking about that, looking at that. And what happens is that colonialism and especially if you're conservative, is that everything is driven by power and money. So what happened was is that in all the little outports around the island of Newfoundland, men getting up 4 o'clock in the morning and risking their life in 16, 18, 20-foot boats to go out and fish, to make the merchants of St. John's rich and to build the Avalon to where it's to now. All of those things were sacrifices by those people in those little communities, and they got very little in return. They didn't have any of the luxuries that the people in St. John's had. They didn't have roads, they didn't have cars, they didn't have electricity, they didn't have hospitals, they didn't have doctors, they didn't have any of those things. So you've got about 300 years, I'll say roughly around 300 years of sacrifice, with only a willingness and an intent to live there for just for a living. That's all those people ever acquired was a living. Some of them were successful in building maybe a half decent home, but that was the extent of it. With regard to material things, they never owned much more material things. They didn't have big campers, and they didn't have trucks and cars, and they didn't have any of that kind of stuff. What they had was they had a shack or just a little above a shack to be able to live in. But for 400, for 300 years and God knows how many generations, they lived that way. And the riches that they earned from the exploitation of their resource being the sea, ended up building the Avalon and building St. John's to what it is today. That's where the money came from. All of a sudden, because now you have an economy that's driven by oil and some agriculture, but a lot of mining and all of these type of things, is that there's no longer a need for the people in Francois and White Bear and Virgil and all those places. There's no longer a need for those people. It's no longer possible for those people to be able to harvest the resources that are on their doorsteps, because at nighttime all they have to do is look through the window and they'll see the foreign fleets in there, or some big companies, some big fishery enterprise in Canada, as factory boats anchored in or just outside their harbors, harvesting the species that were there. So those people are no longer needed. So what happens now is that the people who never ever had to sacrifice anything other than live off the riches of those people, those people in those small outport communities are now a burden on those people. They see them as a burden because they don't want to pay for a generator in White Bear to provide electricity to those people. Neither do they want to have a hospital built in there, a clinic, or have a school in there for such a small population, because that's a burden onto them. They think it's a burden onto them, but it's not a burden onto them when they see a government paying $1 million bonuses to executives whether they're with Nalcor or the offshore or whatever the case may be. They never ever question those type of things because that's what they're accustomed to. That's what they're used to. Their way of life has always been taking, 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 and they never ever had to give. But now they look at the people in those outport communities who have earned. After four generations or five generations or whatever, three, I don't know. But they have earned the right to be allowed to live in those communities if they choose to do so. And if somebody has to bring in their food by helicopter and land it in the parking lot for the rest of the time that they have to live, because it's only the older people that are there. The younger generation have a different outlook, so they're moving elsewhere to be able to pursue job opportunities. So the people that are left there, they're dying off year by year. Instead of imposing a move onto them and putting them in strange environments and making them very feel uncomfortable and suffering for the rest of the time that they have on earth, there should be compassion to be able to give those people what they need in that environment because they've earned it. Now, that's my personal opinion. That's not a maybe it's not a legitimate argument, but that's my personal opinion.
Yeah, it makes me think of the politics of greed, right?
Well, that's what it is.
Yeah, I think we'll have many more conversations, right? But one of the things, I guess it's because where I am now, like I mentioned before, but it's only happened in recent years. I've become super conscious of the whole 11,000 years of Mi'kmaq history, right? And part of the reason why that is because I've been in the habit of walking with my daughters through DeBert, through the Mi'kmaq Park there, where right. was, you know, the oldest, it's the site of the oldest settlement on the east coast of North America, right? And it's a pretty powerful thing, right? And so it makes me think, and also because, you know, Port Royal and where the French originally came, and because the dikes are here that the Acadians built at the time, and so I'm very conscious of that, and so I think of and I'm in no way to, you know, and the whole kind of concept of 400 years of not only violence but control and, you know, dominance and really and even I think like in the case of Newfoundland, the attempt to actually eradicate a whole civilization. So yeah. I was really taken when you, and I really like the idea and I've used it a lot in my own thinking and whatever is the concept of the awakening that you call it in 1969. And, you know, and I've even written books like Confirmation of That, and something happened in 1969. So when you think of where you've gotten to from 1969 until now, do you think that the tide is reversing? Do you think that there is positive progress?
Oh, there's no question about it. No question about it whatsoever. There's been positive progress. Now there's been mistakes made along the way by all parties and all sides, and there's been you know, opportunistic advantages taken of the people, particularly by the federal government when it comes to the negotiation of the agreement that we have it now in place, the formation of Hollywood. But that again stems from the leadership in Hollywood not having the vision or the foresight to be able to include other people in the negotiations and taking it on themselves when they didn't have the ability or they didn't have the mindset, whatever, you know. They might have looked at the empowerment that they were getting by getting a deal, the perks and the large wages and things that they would acquire from being at the top. I don't know if that's factual, but I think that they all factor in there. But putting all of those negativity aside, is that the progress that we've made has been phenomenal. Like 50 years is not a long time. Some people think that 50 years is a long time. Yes, it's a long time when you're looking ahead, but when you look behind, it's nowhere at all. It's only a dream. Our life is only a dream. But we've come from an actual denial that we even exist to an area whereby now there's always been collaboration with the university. We would not have accomplished what we accomplished had we not had that very early contact in the 70s with the university. The university played a very, very important role. And of course, even extension services. You know, Neil Tilley, I knew Neil really, really, really well. Spent a lot of time with Neil at every opportunity that I could get, because not only was he a good friend, but I admired him. There was something about him that made him a little bit special. He was a good human being, and his contribution was phenomenal. But not only to the Aboriginal movement, of course, all of the people who work with extension services continued, contributed to the rural movement in Newfoundland, and a lot of undertakings, a lot of farming projects, and the co-op. And we talked about this before, the co-op on Fogo Island, and all of these things. These are all seeds of extension services. So without the university, it would have been a much more difficult task, and I'm unsure. But I would be brave enough to say that we would have not made the progress that we made in that period of time. It was evident to happen. It is going to happen. It's the clock is not going to turn back. It's going to happen. But it happened a lot sooner by having the access to university. From professors that that came on board, and you summed it up so well, is that the activists and the alliance, but it was the alliance of the university that propelled the activists into getting where we're to today.
What can I say? It's excellent. I think that's okay. Maybe a nice way to conclude for today.